This is WAMU 88.5 News.
From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Kojo Nandi. Later in the broadcast, we'll be joined by D.C. Councilmember David Catania. But first up in this broadcast is U.S. Attorney for the District of Columbia, Ronald Machen. So if you'd like to join the conversation with him, if you have comments or questions, start calling now at 800-433-8850 or sending email to kojo@wamu.org. You can send us a tweet at Kojo Show. Ronald Machen, as we said, is the United States Attorney for the District of Columbia. Thank you for joining us in studio.
Thank you, Kojo.
Tom Sherwood and I have a little business to take care of first. He is our resident analyst. He's an NBC4 reporter and a columnist for the Current newspapers. Hi, Tom.
Hello.
Virginia primary results in the Democratic primary. Virginia Democrats turned out. They nominated Ralph Northam for Lieutenant Governor, Mark Herring for Attorney General Tuesday. We all know, of course, that the gubernatorial candidate is Terry McAuliffe. Any surprises there?
I don't think there's a surprise. I think we have a classic political campaign in front of us in which the right-of-center Republicans are going to talk about the tax and spend liberal Democrats, and the right of left of center, but still pretty much in the center for all of them. Democrats are going to talk about the Tea Party Republicans, who are more interested in social issues rather than governing. And we're going to hear this played out over and over and over and over until November.
Which is why you don't want to go back to covering Richmond again?
No, I think it's really interesting. You know, when Tom Davis has been here and he talks about how the Democrats run up a 200,000-plus majority in the Northern Virginia area and the Republicans have to pick that up somewhere else, and they've got several of the candidates and they'll have Northern Virginia ties. It's going to be an interesting campaign, but I would like to hear some new rhetoric, and I'm not hearing it yet.
As I said, our guest is Ronald Machen, United States Attorney for the District of Columbia. We're taking your calls at 800-433-8850. Ron Machen, the latest news is that Lee Calhoun, a former employee of Jeffrey Thompson's company, Thompson Cobb, Basilio and Associates, is being accused by federal prosecutors of, campaign corruption. This, for me, is important in particular because we've been hearing a lot about Mr. Thompson and Chartered Health. However, today's report says that Lee Calhoun is among numerous employees of former Thompson Cobb, Basilio and Associates who donated to political candidates, often via checks written on the same day. Does that mean there are likely to be more prosecutions of employees of that company?
Well, you know, you're going to start off with a question that I can't answer. It's an ongoing investigation, Kojo, so there's really not much I can say about it. But the court documents will speak for themselves.
And that, Mr. Calhoun, would be, you've just announced the information. It's the legal term.
That's right.
And he'll be in court next Wednesday or Thursday, I believe it is.
Next Thursday, I believe.
And just as in the Michael Brown case, when you did the same thing, your office essentially announces that something that's happened, there's going to be some court action. Then you have to wait for the judge to act before you can publicly comment on it.
Well, usually, normally what happens, I'm not speaking specifically with this case, but normally when you file an information, there'll then be a hearing and a plea will happen at that hearing.
And Mr. Calhoun's lawyer has said publicly, of course, to the other reporters, that he will, in fact, plead guilty next week. So we're not going to worry too much about that. I think what's interesting is for people is your office has really never commented on Jeffrey Thompson directly himself anyway. You've talked only about a scheme without naming names of massive proportions that has lasted for longer than a decade of fraudulent strawman money going into campaigns, both local and national. Do you still maintain that's what you're doing now? Is that still how you would characterize this? This is a massive scheme without naming names?
Well, again,
it seems broader. Pardon me for interrupting you. It seems to me that people are wondering, well, why hadn't he gotten the mayor? If the mayor did something wrong, why hadn't he gotten the mayor? But it seems to me this is a very broad-based scheme that you're trying to connect the dots to.
Yeah, well, I mean, I always want to be very careful not to name names or say anything that could be related to any particular case, because I think that's very important. I can tell you generally, when you start investigations into conduct, a lot of times they'll take you in different directions. And our job is to assess all the facts after looking at everything and hold those who are culpable accountable. And that's what we're doing in each one of our cases.
I guess I'll ask a general question, because the news earlier in the week was former Councilmember Michael A. Brown admitting to being bought off while he was in office by men who turned out to be undercover agents. What's less clear is the original impetus for the investigation. At what point was it decided to approach Brown with the undercover agents? And what cause did you have at the time to believe he was corruptible? And I guess if I was to make that a general question, what causes you to go after somebody who you think might be corruptible?
Well, we got to have a predicate. We don't just target individuals without a reason. And I talked about this at the press conference. With respect to Mr. Brown, we had gotten word that he was open to receiving money in exchange for what exerting political influence. And we had also gotten word that contractors were concerned. They were concerned that if they didn't pay the money, they wouldn't get a fair shake at contracts. But if they did, they'd be involved in a bribe scheme. And so when you're faced with that sort of circumstance, you have to act. And together with the FBI, we did.
It seems like you had a lot of opportunities to bring in this case. According to the documents made public this week, Brown started taking money from your undercover agents pretty quickly. He ended up taking several payments, and your office waited for months to move. What factors do you weigh while you're waiting? I personally would have arrested him after the first time.
Well, you know, you do that, and then the case isn't as strong for whatever reason, and then you don't get a conviction. I mean, one of the things that I've been really proud of in all of these cases is we've built cases that have been pretty strong, and individuals have pled guilty. We've saved the taxpayers years and years of litigation. I mean, obviously, the elected officials should get some credit for that, because they have accepted a decided to accept responsibility early. But that is in large part also a reflection of the strength of the case. And so we're very mindful of the political dynamics that are going on in each individual situation. But at the same time, we can't move prematurely before we have enough evidence to go forward. And we try to build strong cases.
And if someone, and now that Michael Brown has pled, I guess we can talk more directly about him. If he accepts money early on in the first part of the sting, it seems to me premature to cut that off, because you want to know not only what he's doing at that moment, but what other things he might tell you when his guard is not up. But I am astonished
and you want to know if other individuals are involved.
Initially,
yeah, that's right.
What astonishes me as a citizen of the city is to sit home and see that in the midst of the Kwame Brown thing last year, when you were almost fulminating about public corruption and misdeeds and malfeasance and all these things would not be accepted, that you were spending night, days, and weekends going after it, that's when he took the money.
I'm going to add to what Tom said. On a visceral level, what goes through your mind in situations like the most recent special election, when you know what Michael A. Brown is doing, but you're watching him running for office out in the open, talking about issues like ethics on the campaign trail, when you know full well by that point that he's involved in illegal activity?
Yeah. I mean, nothing really surprises you in this job anymore. And obviously, we've tried to be very transparent about our commitment, our dedication to stamping out corruption. We've tried to be clear that there will be severe consequences. So I think it's disappointing. It's doubly disappointing because we do a lot of work in the community. We go to a lot of schools. We go to
We'll talk about that a little bit later.
Do a lot of that. And so when we tell these kids, many of whom are from very poor circumstances, to hold on, to stay strong, to stay on the right path, even though many times they don't have the support structure at home, then when you see somebody who is in a position of influence, who does have a lot of the benefits and has achieved in life, doing something inappropriate, you just can't let that stand. And so obviously it's concerning, but we try to keep our eye on the prize and do what we think is right in the situation and build a strong case. And when we're ready to move, we try to move. If we can do so prior to having any sort of effect on elections will do so. But at the end of the day, the integrity of the case will control.
Michael Brown was running for the April 23rd at large council seat. He abruptly dropped out, citing caring for his ill mother. No one believed that at the time. I even discussed it with him. I said, Michael, no one believes this. Everyone thinks you've either cut a deal with Anita Bonds for something in the future, which apparently wasn't true, or that some prosecution action is pending against you. Can you characterize when Mr. Brown knew? When did the money thing take place?
Well, it was the actual takedown is when he knew the last payment, and that was in March. I can't remember the exact date.
About the time.
But he withdrew from the race because we made it clear he was going to be indicted if he stayed in the race. We weren't going to let a special election. At that point, we thought we had enough evidence. We knew that no one else was involved in taking money, and we were ready to move. And so at that point, he withdrew. Again, but that still took – I give him credit for that. I mean, that still many people would not have withdrawn. Many people – would have said, well, you prove it. They'd have come out with additional public statements. They'd have fought for the next 2 years. He had very experienced counsel. And so just because somebody knows that they have engaged in wrongdoing, it still takes, and I give him a lot of credit, it takes a lot of courage when you're down, when everyone's ridiculing you to accept responsibility. And so and he did that. And so did Kwame Brown and so did Harry Thomas. So, you know, I try not to judge these individuals. We also do a lot of work in reentry. You know, you acknowledge responsibility. You pay your debt. You need to come back. And we need to make sure that we individuals can be productive members of society. But obviously, we weren't going to allow him to run in that special election.
Michael Brown's guilty plea comes after two of his colleagues pleaded guilty to federal crimes last year. We spoke with Councilmember Jack Evans on this broadcast last week. He said that as far as laws and regulations go, their prosecutions are proof that the system is working. Don your headphones, please, so you can hear this.
He is going to pay the price. The system in many ways worked. The FBI caught him. He's going to plead guilty and in all likelihood will be going to jail. And to the voters' credit who elected Michael, they unelected him in his last race and threw him out of office. And so we are where we are on that. But I think we are going to have to, again, those of us in office are going to have to redouble our efforts now to ensure the public that we are an ethical government, that we are ethical members of the Council of the District of Columbia, and other city workers the same thing.
Ron Machen, how would you respond to that assessment? Is it your opinion that the laws the council has in place at the local level are adequate as far as how they pertain to ethics and campaign finance?
You know, that's probably not in my lane. I would say
a political question.
Well,
if you run for mayor, you might have to answer.
Now we've really
messed up. Did I slip that in? But go ahead.
No, I mean, look, I think the legislature has to. We can't ignore the fact we've had three council members plead guilty in the last 18 months to federal felony offenses, and so I think we need to look and see and take a hard look whether the current system of laws and of the administration of contracts and things like that are set up in such a way that they have promoted or allowed this sort of behavior to take place. But that being said, you know, these cases are a reflection of these individuals. They're not a reflection of the D.C. government. They're not a reflection of the, you know, thousands of hardworking government servants. And so I don't want to cast too much of a shadow of neglect and inefficiency on the D.C. government. I think we do have to take a look at this, though. It is important. It's critical, and you know, I think the voters need to ask hard questions of the council members, and you guys will. Has enough been done?
Too many opportunities to abuse the system, Tom.
Well, you raised the word shadow first. Just let the record show. The shadow campaign. When Jeanie Clark Harris pled guilty, I believe that was the time you said that the shadow campaign that helped Mayor Gray get elected deceived the voters of the District of Columbia. Mm-hmm. And you're pursuing that. We're now having, just as we had the special election when Michael Brown was in it, we now have a mayor's race. There are three announced candidates. The mayor has not said virtually anything about this investigation, and he also has not said whether he'll run again or not. How much pressure is there? I know you have to do everything that you have to do to have a case, but how much pressure is there knowing that the election clock is ticking, that there will be candidates this fall, right around Thanksgiving or later, collecting signatures to run in the next primary on April the 1st? It seems like you have the window is tightening.
Well, I think we're aware of, again, the political situation. And obviously, we'd like to be able to resolve whatever we're doing within that window. And that being said, you know, we didn't create this cloud over the city. And you got to remember what the criminal laws are intended for. They're intended to punish conduct that has gone, deeply awry. I mean, these are not just slight errors in judgment, things like that. This is criminal conduct. And so this office, our office, will not be the panacea for all wrongdoing or all negligence by government officials. And so I think that's important to keep that in mind. And so there is pressure, but at the same time, we got to make the right decisions. You will make mistakes and you will not do your job if you react based on public pressure and media scrutiny.
Can I ask a quick question? You have been trying to get access to Jeffrey Thompson's documents, and his lawyer has fought you in various courts along the way. I think the last time I checked in, the Court of Appeals had backed you, basically. Where is the status of that? Do you, in fact, have those? Can you? You're looking at me like you're not going to answer. Yeah, these are court records. These are court documents.
No, I can't answer that, Tom.
But isn't that a court case? I mean, that's been public. The appeal court has ruled one way or another.
Yeah, I can't talk about any of that.
It's hard to pursue corruption.
knew that when you were asking.
No, well, I thought that was a court decision, the Court of Appeals, yeah. and all that. That's been made public.
But he's not going to answer the question.
Because it's an ongoing investigation. I could almost do your job. I'm not answering that.
It's hard to pursue corruption cases without the cooperation of people who know about what's going on in those cases. Allow me to read an email that was sent to this show by Eric Payne. And for people who want to know what that story is, there's a link on our website to a New York Times article about Eric Payne. I'll read part of the email. He writes, "As you may know, a little more than 5 years ago, I was serving as the director of contracts for the district's office of the chief financial officer. We were in the midst of getting D.C. council approval for the lottery. I refused and, using internal channels, reported my concerns within the office of the chief financial officer and the office and the D.C. attorney general. Unfortunately, my disclosures led to my demotion and termination. In the wake of burgeoning local corruption scandals, what is your message to the over 20,000 honest and hardworking D.C. employees who may have knowledge of potential wrongdoing? How might they relay this information to your office and shield themselves from retaliation? I hear from D.C. employees weekly with knowledge of improper conduct, and they're terrified at the thought of losing their jobs for speaking up. What do you say to them?"
Well, first of all, if they do speak up, we don't disclose their identities. We try to build cases without getting into that. And you have to speak up. You have to have the courage to make a stand and refuse to allow corruption to take place. Our office doors are always open. We've given our number on this show many times before, our general number. We have intake attorneys that handle these corruption allegations, and we're going to look into them. We're going to look into them vigorously and aggressively. So I would say I applaud you if you have been one of those individuals that has come forward. But really, if you want a system of government that I think we all want, that is ethical and you know wrongdoing, then you have a duty to speak up.
Are your actions in all these cases prompting the kind of response you want, that people are voluntarily coming in, or are you still having to catch them?
No, we have a tremendous number of people coming forward.
Someone's called it the Mormon Tabernacle Choir is down there singing.
We have a trend. Now, again, not everyone that is coming forward. You know, a lot of times you may have an individual that had an administrative issue, and it's more along that ilk than actual criminal conduct. So, but we do have a lot of folks coming forward, and we always listen to them, and we always try to investigate their allegations.
I get the feeling that this, although you said there are a lot of honest workers in the city government, I know there are because I know them too, but I get the feeling we're very similar to what Prince George's County have, where there is this a broad scale culture of corruption that some of the candidates have even used, that people feel like they can take their little piece on whatever level they are. And is that what you're trying to root out?
Well, I want people to understand if they engage in that sort of conduct in D.C., there are going to be consequences, and they probably need to think about relocating, because I think we've been pretty clear that that's not going to be tolerated. But I don't want to be, give folks the sense that D.C. is this culture of corruption. Again, you know, what we've seen here, we've seen in other cities, and it's something that's serious. It's something that needs to be addressed. But then again, there are thousands of employees in the city government, and most of those folks are hardworking folks that do their job to the best of their ability.
You've heard this before. I'll just ask it straight up because people say it to me. When I was outside Harry Thomas's office when the FBI was invading his house, some African-American guys in a car rode by and said, "Why don't you go stand outside in front of," they named a white council member's name. "Why don't you go outside," some other person, they named another white council member's name. Even with the Michael Brown and the Kwame Brown cases that have now come before and the clear path of illegality you laid out, people are saying to me, why didn't the prosecutor go after more than African Americans? Why don't you go after some of the white politicians?
I think you got to ask who's saying that to you.
We should say that you're African American too,
right.
Of course.
That's right.
And so it's a double whammy on you.
But I would say you gotta ask and say who's asking. I'm in the community probably 3 or 4 times a week, and all I hear is thank you, we appreciate you. I'm in Ward 7 and 8 a lot of times. I can't tell you how many people just say thank you for this, and so I don't hear that. But for those that do say that and do think that, I guess I would say, you know, we prosecute conduct, not color, and we've been very clear about that. If you look at our track record, it's also inaccurate to say we only prosecute black politicians or black corrupt officials. One of the biggest cases, one of the cases I'm most proud of that we've had during my tenure is a U.S. Army Corps of Engineer federal procurement fraud case. I've talked about that case, largest procurement fraud case in our nation's history, $30 million in bribes, over $1 billion in contracts. 15 people have pled guilty to, and they're serving various sentences. A large number of those individuals are white, middle-aged men. It just hasn't gotten as much coverage for whatever reason, but it's a significant case. One of the biggest narcotics traffickers we've convicted is a guy by the name of Sitzman, Gregory Sitzman. Was trafficking hundreds of kilos of cocaine between Canada and Mexico and the United States. He's convicted. He's being sentenced later this month, actually, faces 20 years to life and significant case. That's a
Tom
white middle-aged man. So
Tom mentioned Harry Thomas. I'd like to get back to that case for a second because it was brought to my attention yesterday that court records indicate 4 people provided Thomas with illegal kickbacks, but only 3 were charged with crimes. Is that investigation, in fact, completed?
Wait, say that. I'm sorry, Cole. Just
four people in the case of Harry Thomas Jr. Provided him with illegal kickbacks, yet only 3 of those 4 were charged with crimes. And I'm asking, is that investigation complete?
That investigation is continuing.
It is a continuing investigation. Okay, hold on. We got to go to the phones. Put on your headphones, please.
But what if that question is not as good as mine?
Andrew and Alexandria, you better have a good question or Tom's going to be upset. Andrew, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Yes, hi. If we were in April of next year, what would be some of the top issues for D.C. to be addressing? I know the corruption thing is going on, but what else is going on?
I think that's for you guys, isn't it?
I would think so, because all politics here is local, and Tom Sherwood is the expert. Now you get to ask
your question. I thought it was kind of newsy when you said that you would not have allowed Michael Brown to go forward in that election. So I'm going to keep that in mind in case that applies to any other candidates. But you have, I think, the nation's largest U.S. Attorney's Office. You're deeply involved, and we're not going to get into this because that's a whole different program, the issues of espionage and the tracking of the media and all those things. It's just a huge office. How much of the time do you personally spend on this public integrity issue in the District of Columbia? Is this 10% of your time, 50%? Can you give us a sense of, given all the international and national issues that you deal with in your office, I know you've got a lot of support.
It's the largest U.S. attorney's office in the country.
But you personally, you get weekly, daily briefings. Give us a sense of how you're juggling all of this.
It's a priority, and it's hard to give you a sense because at times I'll spend a tremendous amount of time on these matters. At other times, I may be on to other matters. But we've made it a priority. We have fantastic prosecutors and investigators. I think people are starting to understand that now doing these cases. We also have fantastic managers. And so, you know, I'm not involved day to day, but I am involved. You know, I do get weekly and monthly updates, and at times I become very, very involved in discussions. So,
it's my understanding you're helping to organize a youth summit that will take place at Friendship Collegiate Academy later this month. What are the issues related to public safety, youth, and violence that you're hoping to talk about with the people who attend?
Well, thanks for raising that, Kojo. This is our third annual youth summit, and again, one of the things that I'm most proud of is during these last 4 years, we have really made it a priority to try to focus on intervention and prevention in a lot of different areas. And the Youth Summit is just an opportunity for us to bring kids together to deal with some of the issues they're dealing with, sexual assault awareness, gangs, violence, try to influence behavior so we do not see them in the courtroom. We're very committed, and we have a long history in this office of community prosecution and really having prosecutors have a strong connection to the community. And I think things like this youth summit really help to promote what a priority that is for our office. I'm really proud of the efforts we've made in that area.
This city's going to elect an attorney general, a local attorney general in 2014 to take office in January of 2015. Are you confident, are you satisfied with the way that office is being developed, and so that you can work with that, assuming you're still there, that the U.S. attorney can work with the elected attorney general? Should it be tougher? Is it all right?
Well, I got to tell you, I haven't really focused as much on that. I'm pretty busy doing my job. But I will say I have a good relationship with the attorney general right now, Irv Nathan, and I assume whoever is elected, that relationship will continue with that office.
Would that strengthen the city's ability to fight public corruption if the attorney general is independent of the mayor?
Well,
or is it still going to be your office?
I don't think that's going to really change the nature of the cases or sort of the framework that's built up now. And so I think we'll still handle those cases.
Tom, we're almost out of time, and he won't answer this question, so I'll ask you, Tom. Has Ronald Machen ever considered running for public office?
I would say that he's probably thought about it in the privacy of his own home, but I doubt that he's ever discussed it with anybody.
That's an excellent answer.
Because if he discussed it with one person, then another person would know, and then I'd know, and then it'd be a news story. But, you're not, obviously, you're in the midst of law enforcement, but did you hold office in college, and have you ever run for any kind of student body job?
I have not.
Is it something you would ever consider outside of yours?
It's not something I'm considering now. I'm just trying to do my job. To the
Actually,
best of my
Tom's
ability.
Answer was much better than yours. Ronald Machen is the United States Attorney for the District of Columbia. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
This is the Politics Hour with Tom Sherwood. He is our resident analyst. He's an NBC4 reporter and a columnist for the current newspapers. Tom Sherwood, House Speaker John Boehner released a video this past Thursday previewing the dedication of abolitionist leader Frederick Douglass's statue next week at the Capitol Visitor Center in Emancipation Hall. Mr. Boehner standing in the spot beside Emancipation Hall. This is from the report in the Washington Times where the statue will be placed. Says the statue is part of the nation's effort to recognize those who fought to end slavery. The official dedication is Wednesday at 11 a.m. But there are a lot of people who would say, no, that's not the reason this statue is there, because of the nation's effort to recognize those who fought to end slavery. It's a part of the nation's effort or the nation's responsibility to recognize the District of Columbia, which did not have any statues in Statuary or Emancipation Hall, and Frederick Douglass as a prominent resident of the District of Columbia. That's why he's there.
Well, I don't doubt that the House Speaker meant every word he said, that is the history of Frederick Douglass. But it is true that Eleanor Holmes Norton and your former colleague here, Mark Plotkin, and others pushed very hard for the city of Washington to be represented in the halls of Congress in terms of people who have had influence on this nation, not just the city or state from which that person may have come. So it's a twofer, if I may say so. It's to recognize that this is a place, a real place where real Americans live. We ought to be treated properly and equally with the rest of Americans. And this is one small step on the Hill. So the speaker was correct, but he wasn't complete.
Let's ask our next guest. Were you invited to this celebration, sir?
Yes.
You have been invited.
That's right.
Because he is a member of the D.C. Council. There has been some, I guess, outrage over the fact that apparently the ANCs of the city were not invited. But it is a celebration, and I, for one, would encourage every resident of the District of Columbia.
Is it open to the public?
It's not. To find a way of celebrating this event. Our guest is David Catania. He is an at-large member of the D.C. Council who holds an independent seat. He chairs the council's Committee on Education. Council Member Catania, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Kojo.
800-433-8850 is the number to call if you've got questions for David Catania in general or about education in particular. You recently proposed a 7-piece legislative package to reform the district's public education system. The issues addressed include funding, accountability, promotion, facilities, a lottery, parent engagement, and governance. This has all of the appearances of school reform led by the council, specifically David Catania, as opposed to the mayor. Is it?
Well, or the chancellor.
Well, Kojo, I appreciate time. I appreciate the chance to address this issue. As you may know, 2 years ago, I sought the Committee on Education. For the last 6 years prior to that, the issue of education had been subsumed by the Committee of the Whole, led by both the chairman of the council. Many of us felt that the issues involving schools were such that we needed, a particular member focused just on these issues, and therefore it led to the creation of the Committee on Education, which I'm privileged to chair. Over the last 5 or 6 months, I've been on, what I call the sawdust circuit. We're now at we've finished our 58th school visit. We've had 20 PTA meetings over the last 2 months, many community meetings, et cetera. And what we learned during the course of these visits were the barriers, frankly, that are inhibiting the improvements in our schools. Now, I think over the last few years, we've made a lot of progress with the mayoral takeover in 2007. Through increased funding, through our school modernization efforts, through our impact evaluation tools, which, while imperfect, are a way to evaluate teachers, et cetera. But nonetheless, we still have a good many barriers to the kind of student achievement we want. And I'd like to just mention a few. We still have a 41% dropout rate. The rate of improvement in proficiency in math and reading is averaging 1% a year under school reform. We currently have about 45% of our children who are proficient. Our state goal is 75%. At this pace, it'll take us to 2043 before we hit our goal. Our bottom 40 schools under school reform have seen decreased CAS scores, decreased statewide assessments, and that's concerning. And our achievement gap is growing. There's presently a 54 points that differentiates the proficiency of white students from African-American and a 40% proficiency between white students and Latino students. Again, we have made some progress, but to set the table, we have quite a lot of work to do.
The Washington Post, which has generally been very supportive of the school reform effort, cautioned that they thought you were maybe pressing too hard, and it noted that you had even yourself said some of these proposals may not make it, that they may be in the course of public hearings that you intend to hold, that things might change. But they were worried that the council is going to become the school board, which is what Kojo said. Is it your goal to support the school system through legislation or to radically change it?
No, it's to build upon the successes that we've seen over the last couple of years. But again, I mentioned those statistics not to be a parade, not to enunciate a parade of horribles, but to basically set the table. And that's what the legislation does. What we've learned over the last several months actually informed the legislation. So, for instance, the District of Columbia, in our weighted student formula, does not give additional resources for students who are eligible for free and reduced meals. Virtually every other weighted student formula in the country acknowledges that it costs more money to educate poor children than affluent children, that they face different needs. And so, part of the recommendation is for us to have a weighted student formula that does accommodate four issues of poverty.
Does the chancellor and all these issues, the other issue was whether you've jumped ahead of the chancellor, that she was aware of and in part in knowing of these changes, was not really truly side by side with you in helping shape these legislative proposals.
Well, I appreciate that, Tom. But to be clear, no legislative proposal that I've been a part of or witnessed in 15 years of council work has had more engagement from the executive than this bill, period. It typically legislation is drafted and then you go through a hearing process and then you solicit the input of the executive. We had separate meetings with State Board of Education members, with the Charter School Board, with the charter school operators, with teachers, principals, the Office of the State Superintendent on Education, philanthropists, the Chancellor herself, etc.
all of the parties were at the table prior to the introduction, where we actually sought to solicit their input on a host of ideas.
She just seemed lukewarm when she responded to the Post or other reporters that she didn't really know, that she had discussions with you but didn't really know the scope and the depth of these.
Let me quote her. "I just don't believe that these seven proposals are going to move us to where we need to go, and we have to ask ourselves, what is the role of the legislature?" Your turn.
Well, I understand that. And last Saturday, she and I spent 2 hours at breakfast talking over the item, and we'll be meeting next week to go over the specific proposals. The issue is when I press her on specifics of the bill, do you support this or not? You know, almost universally, the answer is yes. Now, I don't believe, we're going to have, because there are a lot of stakeholders, candidly, beyond the chancellor. Nearly half of our school children are in charter schools, and this bill goes to improved accountability among charter schools as well. So it's not as if, I have to, accommodate only one person's point of view. I'm trying to construct a series of proposals that advances student achievement, that takes into consideration the voices of the many stakeholders. But again, there will be, as I said, we're going to be meeting with the chancellor again this week, and we'll be meeting with her. I've already scheduled nearly 40 hours of hearings for the first 2 months of July to solicit public input on these bills. But, to your other point, Tom, is the council trying to become
the school board?
Every proposal that we have mentioned has its basis in evidence-based research and legislative action from other states, period. What we've grown accustomed, and perhaps, the chancellor and her predecessor grew accustomed to a council that had vacated the field. Having mayoral takeover does not mean council abdication. We have a role to play in this conversation. And in fact, the mayor has forwarded legislation last week to give the chancellor chartering authority. So there's an acknowledgement that there is a role for the council to play. And with respect to opinion formers, whether it be the Washington Post editorial or any pundit, everyone is entitled to their opinion. And this is the great thing about this country. But I want to be clear about one thing. I chair the Committee on Education, and I have four colleagues who are on that committee with me, and we work for 620,000 people. We don't work for a particular pundit or a particular page. And what we hear from the 620,000 residents of the District of Columbia is that school reform is going too slowly. We have an achievement gap that does not reflect our values, and we need a sense of urgency to try to solve these problems.
We're talking with David Catania. He's an at-large member of the D.C. Council. He chairs the Council's Committee on Education. We're inviting your calls at 800-433-8850. Mayoral spokesman Pedro Ribeiro said you did not set up a meeting with the mayor's staff ahead of time to discuss these bills before you roll them out, and that raises what he calls troubling questions as to what your intentions are. How would you respond?
Well, I would be happy to provide the email traffic that illustrates what a lie that is. We actually reached out and asked for a meeting with the mayor. Again, by the way, this is something that is unprecedented prior to the introduction. We reached out in a letter to the mayor requesting that he meet with our team to discuss proposals. We asked for the meeting to take place at our law firm at Hogan Lovells. Every other stakeholder was able to accommodate this, seeing the sense of urgency. He refused to come to Hogan, instead insisted that the meeting be held in the Wilson Building, which we were happy to accommodate. The meeting had, in fact, been set up. And then we received an email saying, well, on second thought, the mayor has decided that, he wants to meet one-on-one and is unwilling to meet with what he characterized as our entourage. Our entourage were the three lawyers who had been working with us, the school reform experts, and we underscored the importance of having the entire team present so we could have a comprehensive conversation.
So just to be clear, the allegation or the statement that you went forward with this without consulting the mayor's executive office, is not true.
It is absolutely not true, and I'll be happy to give you the email traffic, which shows that we went above and beyond in soliciting his point of view and seeking, a meeting with him. And we're willing to go to him on his terms and conditions. And at the last minute, he decided that he only wanted to meet with me directly. And I said, look, I'm willing to meet with you. In fact, we've set up a meeting for next Thursday to meet because I invited him. I said, these are proposals that we have put together over many months of effort. I invite you, Mr. Mayor, to come forward with your proposals because all good ideas are welcome and all hands need to be on deck.
Is this your
Nevertheless, I sense some friction between you and the mayor's office. Is that correct?
Well, it's a healthy friction?
I think it is what it is. I think there is some sensitivity because, candidly, I mean, my concern isn't with our chancellor. I think she is an excellent chancellor. My concern has been with the absence of an agenda on the subject of education. The mayor has announced that next week he will have an address on education. Coincidentally, the same day he and I are going to meet, and he's going to have his address before we meet, which is fine. I welcome his ideas. But it is not lost on me that will be his 901st day on the job as mayor. And it seems to me we ought to have had an education agenda before then.
So the slippage in the reforms that you've already talked about, you attribute to the mayor's office not being aggressive to help the chancellor, so they're now for your council
That's
committee
right.
is. Okay.
That's right. Look, I think
do you understand the mayor also worries that you want to be the mayor is concerned that you could easily be a candidate against him next year. You haven't said you won't run. People have talked about you possibly running in the November election next year. If he's the nominee, if he runs again. So maybe he's worried politically about you, Councilmember Wells, who is an announced candidate, Councilmember Bowser, who is an announced candidate, Councilmember Evans, who is an announced candidate. Maybe he's feeling politically surrounded.
And Tom, if I might, you know, as I mentioned, when I first became chair of this committee, I wanted to make it a goal to visit every public school, and I mean both public, traditional public, and charter. As of this week, we visited our 57th and 58th school. You know, what is motivating us at this point is, you know, is accelerating student achievement and narrowing the student the achievement gap that exists in the city. Whether or not, you know, and again, I'm going to be at the mayor's announcement next Thursday. I've sent him a letter welcoming his proposals sooner rather than later, so we can incorporate them in the hearing notices, so that we can have all good ideas on the table. You know, and I believe the mayor is going to produce some good ideas, and I welcome those good ideas, but I have a sense of urgency here, because I don't believe at our current rate of improvement, it will take us 30 years to hit 75% proficiency in math and reading.
We seem to be annoying John, our listener John in Southeast, who sent an email saying, could you guys please focus on the specifics of the bill and not just the politics, thanks? Hey, John, it's the politics hour. Anyway, we'll concede.
Can I ask people?
I was about to get to specifics.
They're welcome to funding. Go to davidcatania.com, and all the proposals and they're specifically are outlined. And they can go to the site if they want to see some graphs and some specifics.
Well, it does raise per pupil funding for poor children. Can you talk about that?
Well, you know, one of the things we've learned along our journey is that, again, the cost of educating a poor child is different than educating an affluent child. And when I sit and talk with principals, they talk about the need for greater mental health services and certain interventions, including around the issues of literacy. And so we do back of the envelope. How much more would you need? What would it look like? And we're looking at about a 10 to 15% addition for free and reduced meal students to give the kind of interventions and support that we think are necessary for children to succeed. But I'm also looking at having two additional weights. One additional weight would be for high school juniors and seniors for career and technical education. Because last year, you know, again, a graduation rate of 59%, 2,300 kids simply left the system and didn't return. And many of those who did graduate obviously didn't graduate into a swim lane of opportunities. And I think we need to acknowledge that and produce opportunities for those children. And then we have a wait for our underperforming high schools, because they often are, you know, challenged with intense amounts of behavioral issues, and also, you know, children not on grade level. And candidly, that's an expensive proposition and additional weights. And we're not alone here. We studied about 12 other systems that had weights. And weights really do reflect the values of a community. And I'll be very honest here. You know, this city is a tale of two cities with intense poverty. There are a couple of approaches to that issue. We can continue to you know, redistribute resources and maintain in a minimal way the lives of people who are in poverty, or we can actually do something about it and create a better city. And so another option to defeat poverty, right, the enemy of poverty is education and opportunity. If we can actually improve our system of education, we don't have to be saddled with a population that is so with such a huge concentration of poverty forever.
Bruce DuPoit on his show yesterday on News Channel 8.
What show is that?
It's some Will of the Wisp, you know, passing thought show.
After 30 years.
Now I've forgotten my question. He said, well, maybe with this talk in general that you might run for mayor, that if you want to make these dramatic changes in the school system, if you were mayor, you could appoint a chancellor, or you could direct the chancellor, Kaya Henderson, to do the very things here without even some of this. You could go past the legislation to executive action.
Right.
What do you say to people who say this might be a prelude to a mayoral campaign, or not questioning for one second your legitimacy and your intensity of trying to get something done. Where does mayoral politics fit in this?
It just can't be the first issue on our mind. What we have to be thinking about is constructing a system that works for this chancellor, this mayor, or whomever might follow.
Will this mayor be better off if he works with you to get achievements which he can then run himself on, rather than impose you?
And I'm open to that. Again, part of the issue that in the funding bill, Kodjo, in addition to having greater funding for free and reduced meal students, it also devolves autonomy and budget authority to the principals. And the bill would require, as opposed to today, where it's 69% of the money is in the hands of the principals, increasing that to 80%. This is along the lines of what they've done in Baltimore. It's also creating greater autonomy for the principal to decide what to do with those resources. And two jurisdictions that we studied, both San Francisco and Oakland, saw enhanced improvements in statewide testing once principals were in control of their resources and were able to pick and choose those interventions that actually worked for them. So these are evidence-based ideas.
Speaking of funding, we got an email from Victor, who identifies himself as a senior at Cesar Chavez Public Charter School in the district. Victor says, with 80% of the funding DCPS receives from the D.C. government, if schools still aren't performing well, presumably after some time, if schools still aren't performing well enough, what will happen? Will that percentage begin to increase or will it decrease?
So right now, we don't have a local mechanism in our law that will close an underperforming, for instance, DCPS school. The charter schools have a framework to close underperforming charter schools, which this bill actually strengthens. And we've included the requests from the charter school board on how to strengthen it as evidence of us actually working with partners. But with respect to DCPS, there currently is no mechanism that closes an underperforming school based on performance. We close schools because kids stop going. That's the mechanism here. No Child Left Behind is currently under duress at the moment. The Elementary and Secondary Education Act is stalled in Congress. Its reauthorization is stalled, and No Child Left Behind is being weakened by the left and the right. If it disappears, there will be no mechanism for us to close a school or to call the question on underperforming schools. One of the bills that we've introduced, the Individual School Accountability Act, establishes a local standard where OSSE will establish what that
standard is. What is OSSE for people?
The Office of State Superintendent of Education. They'll establish the standard of what is acceptable performance. Schools that fail that performance will be subject to two actions, a turnaround plan or permit the chancellor to create what we're calling innovation schools modeled after Colorado, which will give her the flexibility both with respect to labor contracts and municipal regulations to actually have charter-like authority without the board. The turnaround plans, what I like about them, we recently have gone through an effort where we've reconstituted two DCPS schools. But all that means is we change the personnel. We don't bring additional interventions, curriculum improvements, resources, etc. And we
teachers
certainly
union won't like that.
Actually, the teachers union, I think, would like what we're talking about with respect to turnaround plans, because right now a school is reconstituted and all you do is you change out the personnel. You don't actually change and do a root cause analysis as to why the school failed and build it up. You just change the people. And so what my bill does under the turnaround plan option is it requires that there be a stakeholder group that is school invested, from the principal, a teacher from the school, a parent of a child in the school, etc. And they take the first cut at creating the turnaround plan that's submitted to the chancellor. And you have authentic community input as to what is it going to take to turn that school around, which is very different than what happens now. Look, we have got to build bridges back to our citizens so they feel invested in their public schools.
Why did you ultimately feel it was necessary to hire outside help to put together this package? You raised outside money to pay lawyers from Hogan to help craft your plan. We got an email from Crystal, who writes, why are lawyers considered education experts? Why weren't teachers or parents with children in public school part of David Catania's education entourage?
And how much did that cost?
Well, that's an excellent question, and so let me explain. Becoming chairman of the Committee on Education after 8 years chairing the Health Committee, I didn't have the depth of a bench with respect to educational expertise. And the way I divide my five staff members, I have one who's dedicated to data and research, one community outreach, one content expert, one budget, and then one who handles some administrative functions. I didn't have the bench. And so we interviewed what we thought to be among the best practice groups in the country who are steeped in school reform. And so we chose Hogan and Hart, Hogan Levels, The woman who represents us was herself a former teacher and principal. She was the first female principal of the Montgomery County school system. She's been in this business for 30 years. She represents such systems like Baltimore. She represents Clark County. She represents New Orleans. She represents other systems that are in the process of evolution. Other members of the team are also teachers. The lead associate is currently a PhD student at Harvard in education, having a master's, having taught in schools. And so these individuals do actually have educational backgrounds. But let me be clear, the solutions, the problems which I brought to the table for us to help solve were those which we learned through our school visits. And by the way, my staff was embedded in this process. We shared the research, we shared the work, and ultimately were responsible for drafting.
So you got the last 2 minutes.
I've got to ask you this before we go. We had Ronald Machen here, the U.S. attorney. We've had three council members in 18 months resign in pleading to felonies, different ones. And the mayor's still under investigation. Last year you called for the mayor to resign, Mayor Gray to resign, that he was distracted by these campaign issues and that he was a detriment to the city staying in the job. Two other council members joined you in doing that. Where do you stand now about the mayor? Do you still think he should have resigned? And,
yes.
And how do you just feel about all this this cloud of corruption that does hang over the city?
And you only have about 40 seconds.
Yes. Well, I still think he should resign.
I stand by the comments I made last year. There's no way under God's green earth that you can run a shadow campaign in essentially the same building as a legitimate campaign right next door in a conjoined building where $700,000 of illegal conduct happened and the mayor not know. So he either knew or should have known, but in any regardless, I think he would have done the city a great service had he stepped down last year so that we could move on and get about the business of solving people's problems, because that's what we are elected to do. It's not, trying to stay out of jail.
David Catania, he is an at-large member of the D.C. Council. He chairs the Council's Committee on Education. David Catania, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Coach.
Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. He's an NBC4 reporter and a columnist for the current newspapers. Tom, go back to work.
No, I'm going back on vacation until Monday.
Well, this is a weekend. You don't normally work on weekends anyway.
I work 24/7.
And thank you all for listening. I'm Kojo Nnamdi. Coming up Monday on the Kojo Nnamdi Show, Weighing Options, Maryland's Secretary of Health on what consumers need to know as healthcare exchanges take shape. Then at 1, the intricacies of extradition. NSA leaker Edward Snowden considers his next move. The Kojo Nnamdi Show, noon till 2 Monday on WAMU 88.5 and streaming at kojoshow.org.
Today's programs are made possible in part by Martha Hamilton in celebration of the graduating seniors and scholarship winners at Bell Multicultural High School.